currently listening to Porridge and the tune Sweet Risk from Teething. DOP before that with Keep On, the Nahash Jungle Remix from Don't Stop. I'm DJ Firefly. This is Couch Dancing at WRCT Pittsburgh. If you want to get in touch with me, feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at an investigative report by the Electronic Frontier Foundation criticizing the use of artificial intelligence tools to automate the writing of police reports.
Barra Lipton, a senior investigative researcher, explains the concerns with AI-generated police reports, such as improper reviews and it being used as shields for law enforcement accountability.
We then talk with the producer of a new documentary titled The Last Class. It follows the work of political economist Robert Reich.
Our guest is the film's producer, Heather Kinlaw Lofthouse, who will explain how the documentary takes a profound look at the widening inequalities of income and wealth in the last half century in America.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
Police departments across the United States are beginning to use artificial intelligence tools, like Axon's Draft 1, to automate the writing of police reports based on body-worn camera audio. While the goal is to save time and reduce paperwork, digital rights advocates are raising serious concerns. The Electronic Frontier Foundation warns that Draft 1 lacks transparency, making it hard to tell whether errors or biases in reports come from the AI or from the officer. They argue this could compromise accountability and justice. The ACLU has also flagged risks tied to AI's potential for inaccuracy and bias. Some agencies are moving forward with these tools, but others, like the King County Prosecutor's Office in Washington, are banning them outright. As the technology spreads, it's prompting critical questions. Should AI be trusted to shape official police narratives? And what safeguards are in place to protect the public? Joining us today from the Electronic Frontier Foundation is Beryl Lipton, a senior investigative researcher specializing in government transparency and surveillance technology. She leads large-scale public records campaigns and contributes to projects like the Atlas of Surveillance. That's a searchable database and map documenting the use of surveillance technologies by law enforcement agencies across the nation. Beryl, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beryl, what is Draft 1, and why did its announcement raise immediate concerns in the police accountability community?
Draft 1 is a relatively new feature being offered by the police surveillance tech company Axon. And what it's designed to do is translate or convert the audio that's being captured on Axon's body-worn cameras, which are cameras that many police departments wear on their uniform now as part of their regular patrol. And it converts that audio into what they call the first draft of the police report that law enforcement is supposed to generate after every incident that they are responding to. I think in the police accountability space right now, there's a lot of concern whenever we hear that there's a police technology that involves artificial intelligence. So this involves anything like analysis of camera video or audio or technologies like predictive policing, which use historical data to try to predict when and where crimes will be happening in the future. And when we heard that AI was being applied to something like police reports, which are really a foundational document in a police investigation and really the strongest record that we have of what happened on the scene in a lot of cases, we were really concerned about the ways that AI's many flaws, like its tendency to hallucinate events, could affect how justice and due process are being applied to individuals subjected to that version of the police narrative.
Before we delve deeper into draft one, can you give our audience a brief overview of other common AI technologies like license plate readers and face recognition that are already in use by law enforcement?
Absolutely. So the term artificial intelligence has been used to describe a lot of different technologies that sometimes simply involve some type of pattern recognition or machine learning, or increasingly and more recently, generative AI technologies like we might see with ChatGPT, or technologies that seem to be acting more intelligently as we would think of it as human beings. So as you described, there are technologies like license plate readers, which are essentially cameras that use a version of AI to determine whether there's a car there, what that car's license plate is, and more recently are able to do broader descriptions of the car, identify the type of car, the make, model, dents in its surface. There are also things like face recognition, which can sort of compare an individual face fed into the system to a whole database of faces to try to determine whether there are similarities based on sort of mathematical configurations between different points on the face, and try to get a match between an image that law enforcement has and their whole database of faces. Increasingly, we're seeing more generative technologies and more advanced algorithms being placed on police data in order to try to do things like create leads for law enforcement or make connections between people. And so we're seeing that as real-time crime centers grow. These are centers that are basically ingesting a lot of these different surveillance feeds and sometimes will add additional analysis or data collected from other places. Or, you know, we see things now like draft one where the generative AI is being used to take some of the responsibilities away from law enforcement and try to make what they would consider routine activities, something that can be completed by a computer.
Beryl, what do AI-generated police reports look like, and how do they differ from traditional officer-written narratives?
So in the case of draft one, what they look like is a transcript that has been reformatted to create a narrative out of the dialogue being captured on a police body-worn camera. Traditionally, an officer police report will include a lot of details that aren't going to be captured on audio. They're going to capture things like the impressions that the law enforcement officer had when he or she responded to a scene, the impressions that they had of sort of the truth, trustworthiness of the people that they were talking to, maybe some other environmental elements, things that help to describe the scene that they were in and who was there and how things unfolded, the type of witness statements that people provided. And so a traditional police report is going to have more of a description of the totality of the situation than what we might see in an AI-generated police report, which is, again, based on audio, and audio of a situation is not necessarily going to pick up on body movements or sometimes even tone of voice, because these are elements that, you know, a pure transcript does not include. So I think something that we are worried about with AI-generated police reports is how much of the situation is actually going to be missed if we're only relying on a transcript. I think something else that we're very concerned about is the fact that we have seen in the past that officers will sometimes say things in their interactions with an individual that don't actually reflect what is happening. And so, you know, we think about situations where law enforcement might be saying something to a person like, don't resist. But then when you actually are able to sort of see a video of that situation, you learn that the person wasn't resisting, the person maybe already was unconscious. And so the audio is really able to hide some of the reality of the situation. And that's one of our big concerns with AI-generated police reports.
I understand it's been difficult to obtain these reports through public records requests. What legal or government barriers are preventing public access to these records, especially in apparently states like California? Are there technical limitations built into Draft 1 that make it harder to identify and access these AI-generated reports?
Police reports in general are supposed to be public record in most states. Again, they're supposed to be very foundational narratives of the interaction between a police officer and a civilian. So in general, these are supposed to be subject to public records laws, and in many cases, one will be able to request these records, and unless they're subject to a specific public records exemption, like the exemption that applies to active investigations or other very particular disclosure restrictions, these are supposed to be the types of records that are made public. However, when trying to identify whether these particular reports are generated by a person or by this artificial intelligence system, there is not the ability in a lot of cases to differentiate whether that report was created by AI or by a person, because there isn't anything particular to the report that discloses that. Now, there are sometimes disclosures that are added to these reports, and there's an option on the Axon Draft 1 system that adds a disclosure based on the discretion of the police department that makes it obvious that this is an AI-generated report. But the way that the AI report moves from the Draft 1 system to the actual records management system where reports are submitted and stored allows for a period of alteration by the officer, because these reports are supposed to get a read over from officers. They have elements that are added that say things like add more detail here, where officers are supposed to put in some more of this environmental detail that the audio isn't capturing. But in this move from the Axon Draft 1 system to the actual submission process, it's very easy to sort of remove the disclosure. Sometimes that disclosure or disclaimer is not added by default in whatever system the police departments are using. And there's no history kept in a place that is accessible to police departments that makes it clear which parts were generated by AI or if a report was generated by AI at all, unless it's very clearly made obvious in the text of the report itself. a lot of agencies, when they respond to public records requests like this, are simply going to do some sort of keyword search across their records management system. And so if it doesn't say in the report itself, created by Draft One, it's going to be very difficult, and in fact is impossible, for a lot of police departments to differentiate between those two groups and actually respond to that request.
Beryl, do any agencies voluntarily make these records more accessible? And if so, how?
So some agencies do make them more accessible by actually requiring, as part of their internal policy, that a disclaimer about Draft One usage is included in the actual text of the report. And so I think it's very important with any technology for police departments to have their own individual policies and a really clear understanding for the officers using these technologies about what is and isn't appropriate and what does and doesn't need to be disclosed as they are going through and using the tech, whether it be AI Draft One or any of the other tools that we've talked about. I think it really can vary from department to department. And unfortunately, something that we learned in the course of our investigation is that Axon is interested in lowering the amount of paperwork that police officers have to do. And part of that paperwork are disclosures like whether or not artificial intelligence was added or used in the creation of a police report. They would say that the creation of Draft One was intended to reduce the amount of paperwork that law enforcement has to complete. And by not keeping a clear record of when Draft One was or wasn't used, they've also been explicit in different contexts about the fact that they are trying to prevent creating disclosure headaches by simply reducing the possibility of disclosure at all.
Beryl, what did EFF set out to learn through its public records investigations? And I gather you've reached some tentative conclusions and findings about how Axon is using this technology and deploying it. Tell us about that.
At Electronic Frontier Foundation, when we embarked on this investigation of Draft One, we were really interested in understanding what was being generated by the AI system, how that might compare to the final police report, and how that police report might play in the judicial process and compare to police reports that were generated by law enforcement without any AI assistance. Because we would hate to see a situation where the application of justice for somebody who's subjected to an AI police report is substantially different and worse than for somebody who had the actual human treatment of somebody sitting down and really thinking through the situation that they had seen and been in. And so as part of our investigation, we were hoping to be able to make some conclusions about how these two different scenarios would play out. But really what we saw is that it's very, very difficult in most cases for that sort of analysis to be done because there isn't any clear record kept in most cases about what was created by artificial intelligence and what was coming from the law enforcement officer's own impressions and observations. And so I think the question of how it plays into due process is really important for us, and it's a really important one for defense attorneys and other people in the criminal justice system, because we would hate to see a situation where law enforcement relies on this system, doesn't give additional thought, doesn't do the proper review of the report and make the adjustments that turn it from simply an AI narrativized version of a transcript into something that is a fuller picture of the incident, and see an individual suffer under our criminal justice system because artificial intelligence has taken over the responsibility of law enforcement or a situation where the appropriate application of accountability for a law enforcement officer is not possible because he or she is able to hide behind the shield of an AI-generated testimony about what happened.
So, Beryl, what policy or legislative changes could help ensure that doesn't happen?
I think there are a few steps that can be taken even before this feature is implemented in police departments that would really help mitigate some of the issues around AI-generated drafting of police reports. Of course, one of them is to just not use it at all. And I think that there have been some police departments and jurisdictions that have said, we are not using AI-generated drafting of our police reports. We hear you, law enforcement officers, that doing your police reports at the end of the day takes a lot of time, but they are so important to the criminal justice system and its appropriate processes that we just cannot introduce that level of risk into our system. So they could just not be using them at all. I think something else that could happen before these sorts of features are utilized, our police departments should be having very clear, open conversations with their local attorneys' offices. I have heard from some police representatives that using Draft One is a situation where police officers might ask for forgiveness rather than permission. And I think that that's a very dangerous attitude to be taking towards the integration of AI into these really human-centric systems. So being clear with the local attorney's office, with city council, with the community about the needs that the police department thinks it has when it comes to the time it takes to do the required paperwork and why they might want to use these systems, I think that would be very valuable. And having clear policies internally about the appropriate use of some of these systems. There are a whole range of permissions that administrators within the police department can set about the types of incidents where it's appropriate to use AI. Perhaps it is more reasonable to use an AI report for an incident that didn't result in any finding of crime than it is to use it in a violent incident. So I think being very thoughtful about when and where and how the technology is used, and then being very clear that it was used, those are all important policies to have in place before police officers even get their hands on some of this technology. Draft One is based on a version of ChatGPT, and I have heard from other police representatives that sometimes their police officers will go to an off-the-shelf artificial intelligence system for some of their work. And so I think we're in a place right now as a society where agencies should be putting into place policies for the use of some of these technologies even before they consider or think they might consider their use, because they are so accessible to the average consumer, because their effect on due process can be so great. Just having these open conversations about their use and setting clear auditing and accountability mechanisms ahead of time is going to be really important.
Have you, through any other sources, identified abuses where there was a difference between what actually happened on the street and what is reported through AI?
One of the issues that you run into with public records all of the time, depending on the type of request that you're making, is the issue of fees. And I think something that we ran into, even in the places where we were able to get access to clearly identified AI-generated reports, was the fact that there are large fees for some of these. We had one police department, Colorado Springs, that wanted to charge us $10 per police report, and ultimately for a period of a few months said that the fee to get the records we wanted was going to be close to $34,000. And so in most cases, we weren't able to get any records because the department couldn't identify which ones would actually be responsive. And then in other cases, it was difficult to sort of pin down the sample that we were going to get because of some of the fee issues we encountered.
What role can journalists, watchdog organizations, and everyday citizens play in holding law enforcement accountable when AI enters the picture?
I think one of the most important things that any person can be doing right now is asking questions of their government and their police departments about how and why they're choosing to adopt certain artificial intelligence technologies. The data that's being collected by a lot of these systems, whether they're license plate readers or street surveillance cameras, is really extensive. And people often don't realize the growing surveillance network that police departments are part of that allow data sharing across jurisdictions. I think asking is one of the most powerful things that people can do, because sometimes police departments do not have answers to the questions about who is getting access to some of this data, in part because a lot of this data sharing is being mediated by some of these larger police technology companies, and people at the local level aren't always aware themselves of the ecosystem of police surveillance. So when individuals take an interest and simply ask questions to their local officials, I think that can be an incredibly important way of signaling that the community is not just going to say, sure, do whatever you want. We have privacy rights. We have concerns that are also valuable and need to be taken into consideration when police are adopting these kinds of technologies. At EFF, we run a project called the Atlas of Surveillance, where we have been tracking the trends and the adoption of about a dozen different types of surveillance technologies in communities all across the country. So I think something that people can do to get started is to check out the Atlas and see what kind of technologies are already in place in their communities, because the technologies that communities have today are themselves changing, and the technologies that communities are going to be marketed in the future are also changing and more invasive than ever. Ask the questions, take some interest in who is surveilling what, and I think that's a really important thing that people can be doing right now.
Beryl, how can listeners follow what Electronic Frontier Foundation is doing in this area and all of your other work?
Yeah, thank you. The EFF does a lot of work across digital rights and privacy when it comes to technology and the internet. You can subscribe to our newsletter. You can check out our Deep Links blog. And you can also follow us on Blue Sky and Facebook and other social media to learn more about what we're up to every day.
Beryl, thanks so much for a really informative interview. We hope to stay in touch and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're pleased to be joined by Heather Kinlaw Lofthouse, the Executive Director of Inequality Media Civic Action. She is the producer of the new documentary, The Last Class, a personal portrait of Robert Reich as he reflects on a period of immense transformation, personally and globally. Reich is, of course, the well-known political economist, professor, and author, who has worked for four presidents, including as Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. He's also the co-founder of Inequality Media Civic Action. For 40 years, Reich has taught over 40,000 students and is now retiring. Drawing on his lifetime in politics, he's used his class Wealth and Poverty to offer a deeper look at why inequalities of income and wealth have widened significantly since the late 1970s, and why this poses dangerous risks to our society and democracy itself. Heather is executive director of both Inequality Media and Inequality Media Civic Action, nonprofits founded by Robert Reich to make compelling digital content about inequality and threats to American democracy. She serves as Robert Reich's co-host on the weekly Coffee Klatch podcast, and she produced The Last Class as part of her new endeavor, Coffee Klatch Productions. She first met Professor Reich in 2006 as his student in his leadership and social change class. Heather, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Steve. That was quite the introduction.
Well, apparently it's all true, and we'll find out more about you. Before we talk about your new documentary, tell us more about Inequality Media Civic Action. The organization envisions a country where organized, informed, and engaged citizens shift the balance of power back to the people and drive policy that creates a fairer economy and a stronger democracy. When was it founded, and what does it do to accomplish its mission?
So, Inequality Media Civic Action and Inequality Media are about a decade old, and they were co-founded by Robert Reich. I have been leading them for the past 6 years. I was on the board before that. And basically, we exist to do digital storytelling around inequality and the imbalance of power that exists in America, including as it affects our democracy. And our goal is to use social media to get the truth out and to apply new and real frameworks to what's happening in the news through posts and then explainer videos. That's what we're really well known for. And at this time, when there's so much disinformation, it's even more, and the stakes are so high, it's so important to get the truth out. But also, what we do is we do it in a nesting dolls approach. By that, I mean, we say the same thing or similar things over and over and over again in different forms. Because people are getting information in different ways, and people hear information and kind of click in terms of being informed about something, educated about something, understanding something through different formats. So we do a lot of bespoke motion graphics in our explainer videos. Bob, as I call him, is well known for doing cartoons. That's another way we try and explain complex problems in a way that's compelling and understandable, and then conveying data. We try to use interesting graphs, anecdotes, really speak to people's hearts and feelings and experience of the economy. So it's all through digital media, and we're constantly having to reinvent ourselves given the way the world works today, Steve. As you know, it's wild out there in the media landscape.
Heather, your organization asserts that, quote, the concentration of wealth has fueled a concentration of influence that distorts our democracy, erodes trust, and stacks the rules against working people. Why do you call that not just a problem to study, but a crisis to fight?
Thank you, Heidi. So, I mean, the world's richest man gave $250 million to help elect Donald Trump, and then went to D.C. and attempted to dismantle everything. I mean, if that's not a case study in the influence of money in politics and our everyday lives, I don't know what is. Of course, I'm referring to Elon Musk. So that's one example. I think there is a distortion, and Bob has been talking about inequality for 40 years, and its impact on society, its impact on democracy, its impact on our daily lives. And if you look at what is propelling this distortion and what is propelling this reality, so much of it is the influence of big money in our politics. It's big money in elections. This has happened on both is happening on both the Democratic and Republican sides. And as the world's number of billionaires have increased. Their amount of wealth has increased exponentially. Their amount of power has increased. And we have to follow the money. We have to see what is happening. If there's not a populace, a demos, right, the part of our democracy that are all these people that are supposed to be represented, there's an imbalance. A small amount is influencing what's happening for the greatest number of people. That's not how a democracy should work. A, should work. And then B, we know for sure, and this is what we try to say, that it's not working. The minimum wage has not budged in real terms. You know, people I heard on NPR yesterday, people earning a minimum wage in all places in this country cannot afford a two-bedroom apartment rental on average. I mean, this is a system where certain people have advantages and connections and a lot of other people don't. That's a problem.
Heather, let's talk about your new documentary, The Last Class. I saw it last week in a standing room only movie theater. I was deeply moved by seeing a man who's taught for four decades, teaching his last class. But I was also grateful to see that he's been teaching at UC Berkeley in the most recent years to a very diverse group of students at a public university. First, tell us about your relationship with Robert Reich and how this film itself came about.
Thank you so much. It was standing room only, but I'm glad no one was actually standing for a 71-minute movie. It was so terrific. I'm so glad we found each other afterwards. I'm so glad you found it deeply moving. So many people are, which is so exciting. And they're saying things like, it's an antidote to despair. I feel hope. I feel re-energized. So The Last Class, of course, Bob was my teacher, as you said in the introduction you gave me. And that was when I was a graduate student in public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. That was 20 years ago now. So I have firsthand experience of his teaching. Now, that was a smaller class. That was around 80 people. And the class that he has technically retired from was this 750-person minimum, because people snuck in and were in the aisles, by the way, class called Wealth and Poverty. It was an undergraduate course at UC Berkeley. The number of teaching assistants he had for this class was around 30. So the teaching assistants were a class in and of themselves. I mean, there's a whole pedagogical method to what it means to be a teaching assistant for him. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with encouraging critical thinking and not spoon-feeding information and not allowing students who often are tempted to say, you know, what do we have to regurgitate on the test, to say, no, we're not giving you the answer. Right? What do you think the answer is? My opinion isn't everything, Bob says. What does my opinion matter? I mean, let's look, what are you seeing? You know, he's constantly asking that question. So I got to see that up front, and it was glorious. It was such an important class for me as part of my graduate education when I took a class with Professor Reich. And so I have been working with Elliot Kirshner, who is an exceptional digital strategist and writer. He makes science documentaries as part of the Science Communication Lab most of the time, but we recruited him, I did, to help think about how do we document Bob's last semester teaching this huge undergraduate course that has been so foundational for so many students. And Elliot said, this man is so incredibly profound and human and willing to discuss how he's processing things. And that's what we need to capture. Not only his incredible talent teaching, but the way he's so willing to be vulnerable, the way he is so inspired by young people, the way he has fought bullies and keeps up the fight when there are so many bullies in today's society here, you know, and it's bullying is almost on a pedestal. It's not just that there are bullies, it's that bullying is back in and trendy. So Elliot and I got together, we got a bunch of terrific cinematographers to come in and capture things, and we were going to make a short film, Heidi and Steve. That was the plan. It was a short film. It was going to be some videos, maybe a, you know, something on YouTube, 20 minutes. And then we looked at the footage once we got it all. which was not much as these things go. 37 hours. Many feature documentaries have 400, 500 hours. And so we looked at it. We did this assembly cut and we said, we don't know what to trim. We don't want to lose that part of the arc. And so our tremendous editor, Josh Melrod, helped bring it to life, working very closely with Elliot. And here we are today with a finished product that you've seen. And if listeners want to know more about the film, where they can watch it, see the trailer, you go to thelastclassfilm.com.
Well, Heather, I can't wait to see The Last Class, so that's on my immediate list of things to do. One reviewer has commented that Reich seemed troubled when he talks about what he sees as, quote, the consensus fatalism of his pupils. And at one point in the film, he asks them, are you so laden with a sense of doom that you think everything will end? Pushing back, he says, pessimism is fine, cynicism is not. What do you think he meant by that? And do you share his impression that young people today feel a sense of fatalism?
This is such a good question or series of questions, Heidi. And I do think that Professor Reich is troubled when he talks to his students and they say, you know, as he says in the film, he says, so a group of students said to me, I said, what do you call yourselves? Are you Gen Z? They said, we call ourselves the last generation. And he said, I'm sorry, the last generation? I think that he is troubled. I think it's so, and I think he's worried. I mean, how can we not be looking at the way society is going and democracy is going and the state of the environment? You know, so many students talk about that and they're very worried. They're worried about their colleagues in terms of ICE. They're worried about their paychecks. They're worried about their families, healthcare, so much to be worried about. And so he says, it makes sense. I validate your concerns. I validate your feelings. I validate your experiences. But what we can't do is get so bogged down and so taken by what certain people, whether it's MAGA, whether it's evildoers out there, want us to feel. We can't take on the cynicism. We can't, because that means we're not in a place of action. We are no longer feel a sense of agency. And so being disgruntled and worried and upset and negative is one thing, and it's justifiable and it's the reality. But getting to a place where you think, well, there's nothing we can do about it, it is too far gone. He fundamentally doesn't believe that we are too far gone. He believes a reckoning is going to be the beginnings, the foundation of a reckoning are being founded, because there's no denying how bad it all is right now. We were able in some ways to put on blinders before, wrong though I think it was. And so here we are where he looks at young people and he says, you can take this fight on. I've been here a long time. And I have seen, you know, around when I was in Berkeley in the 60s in Vietnam, I didn't know what would happen to this country, but we got out of it and I have faith in you. That's basically what he says. And I would agree with that. And we do, we work with a lot of young people at Inequality Media Civic Action. And I think people are showing up. They're saying, I do think that we can have the society and the world we want to. I do think it's possible for change. You could say that and be negative, but it's hard to believe change is possible when you're a cynic.
Heather, this documentary was filmed before Donald Trump was reelected. And today, many of us are feeling pessimistic and some are cynical whether our democratic institutions are equipped to restrain Trump. You work closely with Robert Reich. How is he feeling? How are you feeling in these dangerous times when it comes to economic inequality, the future of democracy, and how the resistance will organize and mobilize to oppose what Trump is doing?
So as you say, we feel pessimistic and we're trying to avoid the cynicism. I mean, we have our Constitution. We have three branches of government, and we are watching them operate in a way they have not been designed to operate. It is highly concerning, and that is an understatement, right? So our institutions are being tested and overridden in many examples. We do think that this is an opportunity for education. This is an opportunity for awareness building. This is an opportunity to see the cracks for what they are, again, and that they're undeniable now, and use that as motivation to adjust things. Use specific examples to see where the system was broken. Use what we're learning and what we're suffering from. You know, and so many people are suffering right now and will suffer more as things roll out. We're only at the beginning of this administration. And I think we have to use this as an opportunity to figure out where the levers are, where we can have the most change and the change that's going to be needed. So we have midterms elections coming that I think people are already planning for. It's amazing to see how much planning people are already doing. I would say there's a lot of coordinated strategic conversations happening at a level that I think I personally haven't seen. And so those, I think we hold on to those kinds of things and we think, where are the places we can make a difference? And what Inequality Media Civic Action is doing is constantly sharing the truth, getting information out, and trying to give people reassurance about certain things where there can be reassurance conveyed.
Heather, your organization's website talks about the power of storytelling and that, quote, stories are how people understand the world and decide to act. The right has used storytelling for decades to build power. It's time progressives did the same. Tell us why you believe that and how you see Inequality Media Civic Action playing a role today in helping progressives build power and resist Trump.
Right. So I do think that we know this. We have lizard brains. There's so many studies and articles about how people are consuming information, the number of people, full ranges, right, who are getting their information online. And so how do you get into someone's feed, right, dominated by algorithms? How do you grab people's attention long enough to be able to educate them on something when it's such a flooded market with lies, with, you know, marketing insanity? I mean, it's really overwhelming for people. So the challenge for us is to break through with videos and posts and content that actually speaks to people, that actually someone stops and they say, wait a second. So if I get pedantic about it, if I may, the first 3 seconds is incredibly important. The first impression you get from a post is incredibly important. So we're often thinking about the initial visuals and what will get someone to stop and what matters. And so we've tracked the polling. It's been amazing to see Mamdani just win, speaking of a progressive in New York, what did incredibly well for him in terms of talking about healthcare, what he would do for housing. Grant, you know, it was housing that's been locked in since the 70s, so it's not necessarily new housing, but what he said about early childhood education and pre-K and offering it for free and how these things polled with people. So that is what is resonating with people. So these progressive policies, and I think that often corporate Democrats worry, you know, we have to, the status quo, and we have to stick with it. And this is not what, for example, in Manhattan, in the New York area, people are wanting right now. So what we do is we look at what is actually going to benefit the largest number of people, the working class, you know, what is going to benefit them? What policies are out there? What's hurting them? Whether it's corporations who are price gouging, what's the real story behind that? So we pick these stories that resonate, and then we try and design content that conveys the real lessons, the real frameworks. And if something new happens, in the news cycle, which is constant. Then we try and get that into people's feeds in a way that says, this is the bigger picture, or this is the important angle on exactly that. And so we do hope that we are helping progressive people have a sense of what to support and where to look and how to keep learning and how to keep the fight up. And we just, every day we have to iterate. You know, we have started doing billboards. We have, we're on Roku now trying to run some videos. I mean, we just constantly have to keep reinventing ourselves to keep up with the pace of it all.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Stephen Rohde with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. Today, we're joined by Heather Kinlaw Lofthouse, the Executive Director of Inequality Media Civic Action. Heather, you talked about content and storytelling and videos. Tell us more about what Inequality Media has developed and produced over the last several years.
So we have the two organizations. One is a 501c3 and one is a 501c4, Inequality Media and Inequality Media Civic Action. We are constantly putting out videos. On the Inequality Media Civic Action side, we have a podcast that Bob and I do that you referenced once a week that comes out on Saturdays called The Coffee Clutch, where we review the news of the week and I probe him on what he's thinking, and we talk about how, you know, our experiences of the week, and it's informal, I would say. So that's one product. The other thing is, it's important to know that this wealth and poverty class that is featured in the Last Class film is available online for anyone to take. So that is on the YouTube channel of Robert Reich. So you look up Robert Reich on YouTube and you can find the wealth and poverty class that is featured and, you know, the center point of this film, this documentary we just made. So that's thousands and thousands of people have taken it online. And we, if you subscribe to our YouTube channels and follow us on Instagram and Facebook, we are constantly putting out rapid response videos. We have a whole series of videos. So some we do incredibly quickly, and we get out, the team at Inequality Media Civic Action is phenomenal. And we also have what we call our hero explainers. It's hero content. It takes longer to do and they're more evergreen. And so we do compilations of those and we put those up on YouTube, and those have been incredibly important. And I also just want to say thank you to the many teachers out there who are using our videos, who are using the films, The Last Class, and then of course, Bob was part of two documentaries years ago that also feature so much about his perspective teaching and the students. That's Inequality for All and Saving Capitalism. So many teachers are using our content in their classrooms, and I'm so grateful and happy to be able to make it all for use. So thank you to the teachers. I have to say that.
And thank you for everything that you're doing. Heather, how can our listeners learn more about The Last Class and also stay abreast of what Inequality Media Civic Action is doing?
Our film's website is the best place to go, thelastclassfilm.com. Thelastclassfilm.com has our list of theaters. Stephen, Heidi, we are in 49 theaters across 22 states. The reaction to this film has been gratifying and phenomenal. I mean, I can't get over it. And people are so motivated. They say, seeing it in the theater, I met a new person I sat next to. I felt community. I felt hope. I felt sad. I felt all of it together, and a togetherness that I haven't felt in a long time. So thank you to everyone who's going to see it. Again, there's the website, thelastclassfilm.com. And then we also have a Substack for The Last Class Film that we're posting on a couple times a week. And that's fun because it has behind the scenes stuff. That's from Elliot Kirshner and our whole team. Anna Ely, Eliza Schiff, we have just a phenomenal team helping us get things going and keeping it going. And we are hugely grateful to small art theaters, these independent theaters that are welcoming the film with open arms and the people that are showing up. So we have, for example, Steve, you and I met at the Rialto Cinemas in Sebastopol. There's the Rialto in Elmwood. So this is Kai Boyd and his team, Roxanne. I mean, we have all these. The Quad in New York has been showing the film for 4 weeks. independent documentary film. The New York Times didn't even do a review of us, of our film. And we've been in the quad for 4 weeks. So it's just been incredible. We want to keep the theatrical push going. And then we're going to be bringing it in other ways. We're going to be doing what's called theatrical on demand, where people can say, you know what, I want to bring it to my local theater. I'm going to set a date and I'm going to try and see if I can tip the theater, sell enough tickets, get enough people in, around 40, 50 people, and see if I can have the theater show it. And so that's happened for the first time in Folsom, California. In September, there'll be a showing there that is viewer-generated, community-driven. And then, of course, we'll be looking at how to do it on demand, how to offer it on demand, and maybe streaming down the line. But it's thelastclassfilm.com is where to go. And then for Inequality Media Civic Action, again, you can follow Inequality Media Civic Action on all the social platforms. Trust me, it's all of them. It's Blue Sky. We're still on Mastodon, all of it. Or you can follow Robert Reich. Both of these places have our content, our explainer videos, and otherwise. And the other thing I should add is that Professor Reich has a new book coming out. I think it's his 19th, and it's a memoir. It's called Coming Up Short, A Memoir of My America. It talks about how boomers were handed so much and what they perhaps could have done differently. It's a terrific read. I know because I got a pre-order copy. So feel free to go online and get that. Bookshop.org is a fabulous resource.
Heather Kinlaw Lofthouse, thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder. And please tell your colleague, Robert Reich, that he may have retired from teaching in the classroom, but we all still have a lot to learn from him. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to have been here.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll focus on recent Supreme Court decisions that can allow President Trump to dismantle numerous government agencies, including the Department of Education. We'll also follow up on the closely watched trial of the case, American Association of University Professors versus Rubio.
We're glad to have our very own Stephen Rohde, a constitutional scholar, speak to us about the implications of these dire attacks on democracy. We then take a look at the MAGA ideology with returning guest, Monthly Review editor John Bellamy Foster.
We'll discuss his recent Monthly Review article titled "The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime."
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
This half hour, we continue our ongoing effort to understand in real time the upheavals taking place within our U.S. government, as well as the blitz of attacks on the rule of law, and that includes attacks on judges, lawyers, academics, students, and virtually anyone else who is critical of the Trump administration's policies and actions. Today, we'll be particularly focused on recent Supreme Court decisions that have paved the way for Trump to dismantle the Department of Education and numerous government agencies. The decisions also limit the public's ability to challenge government overreach and have led to swift deportations to countries in which detainees have no prior connection. We'll also follow up on the critically important First Amendment and Academic Freedom case, American Association of University Professors versus Rubio, which is in trial right now in Boston. Our guest on this subject is our very own co-host, Stephen Rohde. He is a legal scholar, writer, lecturer, and political activist who practiced civil rights and civil liberties law for over 50 years. He's past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He's also a co-founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace and a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He hosts the podcast Speaking Freely and is, of course, a co-host here on Law and Disorder. Of course, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself today. Stephen Rohde, welcome to the guest seat on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with both of you today.
Well, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to allow the Trump administration to gut the Department of Education, a decision that Ian Millhiser of Vox magazine called the biggest victory of Trump's second term. The decision was one of many controversial decisions that was heard on the court's so-called shadow docket. Tell us about the case and the shadow docket.
Thank you. Yes, we're going to be talking about this shadow docket. I'm beginning to call it the shameful docket. I think listeners presume that when a Supreme Court decision comes out, it's gone through the process. There's been briefing. There have been the availability of amicus briefs. There has been an oral argument. The judges have conferenced and come up with a decision, issue that decision with reasoning and analysis and legal authorities. And sometimes there are dissents that disagree with the majority opinion. Well, this season in the Supreme Court,